The headlines, President Rouhani says the Iranian nation's resistance will force the next U.S. administration to return to its commitments and remove anti-Tehran sanctions. The United Nations General Assembly votes overwhelmingly against the Israeli occupation and in support of Palestinian self-determination. And also in our headlines, several European countries impose new coronavirus-related restrictions as the pandemic shows no sign of abating across the continent. Hello and welcome everybody here in Iranian capital Tehran. This is World News. It's our top story for this half hour. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says Iranian nation's resistance will ultimately make the United States respect their rights. Rouhani said he has no doubt such a resistance will force the next U.S. administration to return to its commitments and remove anti-Tehran sanctions. He also reiterated Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei's remarks on Wednesday that Tehran should also focus on attempts on neutralizing the sanctions first. Rouhani was virtually addressing an inauguration ceremony of a series of national projects. He hailed the unveiling of projects across the country during the coronavirus pandemic and despite, quote, an economic war imposed on the nation. Iran has rejected a recent UN General Assembly resolution on human rights situation in the country, saying it lacks legal validity. The foreign ministry spokesman said the architects of the resolution are trying to use international institutions as a tool to exert pressure on Iran. Said Khatibzadeh said those behind the move have a long history of severe and systematic human rights violations themselves. He also accused the supporters of anti-Tehran resolution of giving it to U.S. bullying and ignoring Washington's economic terrorism against the Iranian nation. Khatibzadeh urged them to stop interfering in other countries' internal affairs. On Wednesday, the UN body adopted the Canada-drafted resolution accusing Iran of systematic rights violations. European countries and the Israeli regime were among the main backers of the resolution. The United Nations General Assembly has overwhelmingly adopted a draft resolution in support of Palestinian self-determination.
The result of the vote is as follows: in favor 168, against 5, abstentions 10. Draft resolution 2 is adopted.
Meanwhile, Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki expressed his gratitude to the countries that voted in favor of the document. He called on the international community to find mechanisms to implement its obligations and resolutions to safeguard the rights of all peoples in the interest of maintaining international peace and security. The top diplomat also called on UN member states to fulfill their responsibility to protect the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people. He further called on them to take practical measures against the Israeli occupation and those rogue states that further encourage Tel Aviv to commit crimes. Saad Nimr, a professor of political science at Birzeit University, says a new UN General Assembly resolution in support of Palestinians comes against a backdrop of U.S. support for the Israeli regime.
This is not the first resolution anyway. Many resolutions regarding the self-determination for the Palestinian people had passed during the period before. But the new thing about it is just to confront what is going on by other decisions by America or the deal of the century. This is to say clearly that the right of the Palestinian to self-determination is secured in the United Nations, and it should go ahead in a practical way. Now, till now, we have resolutions, but there is no means of how to apply this self-determination by the Palestinian. What is the means by the United Nations to implement these kind of resolutions on the ground? That's the question.
COVID-19 infections are rapidly increasing in the Gaza Strip and straining its ailing health system. Meanwhile, Israeli blockade has systematically undermined local authorities' efforts to fight the deadly pandemic. And Asher Shannon has more in this report.
The Gaza Strip is witnessing a sharp increase in coronavirus infections, with thousands of cases being discovered on a daily basis. The Gaza Strip has logged more than 30,000 COVID-19 infections, mostly since late August. Hospitals in the blockaded enclave are running short on intensive care units to treat coronavirus patients. Experts say the Israeli blockade imposed on Gaza is the main reason why tackling the deadly pandemic is particularly difficult.
The blockade had devastated the Gaza Strip even before the coronavirus pandemic. Now our health sector suffers from acute shortage of medicines and hospital supplies. The health sector is falling apart, and the world must immediately intervene and help the Gaza Strip fight the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus is fast spreading in the tiny enclave, and people fear the worst because of the high population density.
The health sector has been under pressure because of the blockade, and the coronavirus pandemic has only made things even worse. Over 200 people in Gaza have already died because of coronavirus.
The Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment, despite the alarming number of coronavirus infections.
We demand an immediate end to Israeli violations that amount to war crimes. We also hold Israel accountable for its illegal actions. Medicines and hospital supplies must be allowed to enter Gaza to help fight this deadly virus. The main obstacle to fight the coronavirus pandemic in Gaza is the Israeli blockade.
The United Nations has warned that the enclave's health system could collapse if the number of cases continues to rise.
Gaza's health system has been battered by the Israeli blockade and three wars since 2007. The dire situation has worsened amid the coronavirus pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The United States sets a grim double record in terms of its new COVID-19 cases and fatalities. Over 3,700 died and more than 250,000 cases were reported in 24 hours. The country has seen a marked spike in its infections for more than a month now. This is while almost 113,000 people are currently hospitalized due to the virus. The overall death toll stands at more than 307,000, and the total number of infections at nearly 17 million in the country. The U.S. started vaccinating healthcare workers and elderly people this week. Meanwhile, Brazil, which is the second worst affected country in terms of fatalities, after the U.S. also reported a daily record of more than 70,000 cases. That brings the country's total confirmed cases to over 7 million. With 182,000 deaths. The COVID-19 pandemic in Europe shows no sign of slowing down as several countries impose new restrictions to curb the spread of the virus. Russia's daily coronavirus cases top 28,000, bringing the country's total number to over 2.76 million. Germany registered nearly 27,000 daily infections. Germany went into lockdown on Wednesday to try to curb the spread of infection. Officials have warned that the situation is likely to get worse during Christmas. In the Czech Republic, the total death toll surpassed 10,000. The country is one of the hardest hit in Europe during the second wave of the pandemic. It has imposed a strict second lockdown over the holiday period. Bulgaria has also extended its lockdown restrictions until the end of January. And the UK is reviewing its decision to give the nation a five-day break from COVID-19 restrictions. There's been a surge in infections and a new strain of the virus detected since the decision was made. Bianca Raimi tells us more.
In the UK, up to three families will be allowed to form a bubble under one roof over the festive period. That's less than a week away, and amid a surge in infections, London and nearby areas have entered Tier 3, the highest level of local restrictions in England. A UK cabinet minister has urged Britons to use their personal judgment on whether to meet under relaxed coronavirus measures over Christmas.
And my view is that the government can set a legal framework and then it's for people to use their good judgment. You can't legislate for every eventuality, particularly something as sensitive as Christmas, where people will come to different judgments based on the vulnerability of their own family and how important this is to them.
Across Europe, governments have warned of a spike in infections if Christmas gatherings go ahead as normal. In Germany, restrictions have been tightened and all businesses selling non-essential goods have closed. Over Christmas, only five people from two households will be allowed to meet, not including children under 14.
Ladies and gentlemen, the situation is more serious than it has ever been in this pandemic. The total number of cases is higher than ever, and it continues to rise. There is a danger that the situation will continue to worsen, making it more and more difficult to deal with the pandemic and its consequences.
Italy and the Netherlands also plan tighter lockdowns over the holiday period. Meanwhile, all eyes are on the European Medicine Agency, which has been under pressure to approve the Pfizer vaccine.
It is good news that approval can be granted on 23rd December, as things stand today, that is, if the data which is now being processed further becomes available. We can be optimistic that approval can be granted on 23rd December, which is good news for the entire European Union.
The UK was the first country in the world to authorise emergency use of the vaccine. In the first week, 137,000 people have been vaccinated. The number is expected to increase as GP surgeries are given supplies of the jab and care homes will follow. With a record economic slump brought on by the pandemic, the UK is hoping an attempt to spread holiday cheer does not backfire spectacularly. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Eurozone finance ministers say a successful rollout of COVID-19 vaccines is imperative to saving the EU's economy. The coronavirus pandemic is fueling an economic slump in the 27-nation bloc, resulting in rising levels of poverty, Jerome Hughes reports.
Thousands of businesses across the EU have closed their doors permanently due to the impact of COVID-19. In some of the bloc's countries, cafes, restaurants and hairdressers, like here in Belgium, remain in lockdown. Hundreds of thousands of young people who have precarious employment contracts are losing their jobs. Eurozone finance ministers, known as the Eurogroup, have just concluded their final meeting of 2020. They are pinning all their hopes on effective vaccines.
If vaccines are made available to all Europeans over the course of 2021, we could see a swifter than expected return of GDP to its pre-pandemic levels.
Never before has there been so much economic uncertainty in the EU.
It's a serious source of concern, and we also see that there is very little progress made on poverty and social exclusion, which remains at very high level in the EU.
Faltering trade negotiations between the EU and UK are compounding the problem.
We hope that a successful agreement is possible, but of course we want the right agreement and an agreement that is durable.
Even those who have kept their jobs are feeling the pinch. So-called in-work poverty is increasing in the EU. The European Trade Union Confederation says a quarter of EU member states are providing little or no support for those who are self-employed. This is a particular problem in Bulgaria, Croatia, Cyprus, Germany, Hungary, Italy and Spain. Despite COVID-19 and Brexit, Eurozone finance ministers are expressing optimism. Business groups, though, are forecasting long-term economic challenges for the EU.
That is because of structural problems, most experts agree. For example, there is still criticism that education systems do not meet the needs of employers. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkey says it will not turn back from its deal to buy the Russian S-400 air defense missile system. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu also said that Ankara will take reciprocal steps after evaluating sanctions imposed by the United States for buying the system. He called the sanctions decision legally and politically wrong, adding that they will have no impact on Turkey. Cavusoglu noted that ties between the two countries can normalize if Washington wants to. On Monday, the United States imposed long-anticipated sanctions on Turkey over Ankara's procurement and testing of a Russian-made S-400 air defense system. Turkey condemned the decision as an attack on its sovereign rights.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said his country will no longer be affected dramatically by U.S. sanctions. He also accused the U.S. of imposing sanctions on Turkey to prevent it from becoming independent and developing its own defense sector. Erdogan's comments came after U.S. imposed sanctions on Turkey's defense industries and its chief.
This decision is a blatant assault on our nation's sovereign rights. This has been imposed for the first time against us, a NATO member. What kind of an alliance is this? Now we will work twice as hard to make our defense industry fully independent.
Turkey has always criticized the US for its unilateral actions against other countries in the region, such as Iran.
This is not the first time that the US imposes unnecessary sanctions on other countries. The sanctions come as a punitive act against any country trying to become independent. but I think that Turkey will overcome the sanctions.
Washington had already punished Ankara in July by barring it from developing parts for and acquiring America's next generation F-35 fighter jets. Earlier, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif condemned what he called U.S. addiction to sanctions and contempt for international law. The sanctions cut off Turkey's top defense procurement agency from U.S. financial institutions, military hardware, and technology. Ties between the two NATO allies, Turkey and the U.S., were strained last year due to Ankara's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia. However, Turkey says it had to resort to Moscow to meet its needs after its own allies stopped responding to its demands. Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
An unmanned Chinese spacecraft, Change-E5, on its lunar mission has successfully landed back on Earth. China's National Space Administration said the capsule touched down in the northern region of Inner Mongolia in the early hours of Thursday. The Chang'e-5, equipped with cameras and four arms, was launched in November with the aim to collect lunar rocks from a previously unvisited area in a massive lava plain known as Ocean Storms. These materials will help scientists understand more about the moon's origin and formation. The success of the mission would make China the third country to have retrieved lunar samples following the U.S. and the Soviet Union decades ago. Italy and Iran have launched an exhibition at Rome's Museum of Classical Art, which focuses on the World Heritage Sites in Iran. Affinities between the Italian and the Iranian cultural heritage are once again in the spotlight. Max Givini reports.
An exhibition called Beyond the Columns of Media opened at the Museum of Classical Art based in Rome's La Sapienza University. The initiative, sponsored by the Italian ambassador to Tehran, Giuseppe Perrone, is the result of collaboration between the Italian Archaeological Mission in Iran and the Ministry of Cultural Heritage, Tourism and Handicrafts of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran's ambassador Hamid Bayat and La Sapienza University rector Antonella Polimeni were among the attendees of the event. The exhibit features 16 panels put together by Italian students, representing an ideal journey through the great ancient trade route and communication network known as the Silk Road. Panels portrayed the historical region of the media between the Mesopotamian plain and the Iranian plateau. The exhibition itinerary follows a diachronic development that starts from the Iron Age through the dynasties of the Achaemenids, Arsacids, and Sassanids.
Italy and Iran have long-standing connections that go back in history and have resulted in a deep understanding between the two countries. The cultural and political relations date back to the time of the Roman and Persian empires and are marked by important affinities.
Due to the COVID pandemic, most academic activities have been carried out remotely via video conference. All attendees wished for a prompt return to pre-COVID ways of working. Max Civili, Rome.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing National Bird, directed by German filmmaker Sonja Kennebeck. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him, we have Dan Glazebrook, who's a journalist, political analyst, and author of the book Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis. Now, National Bird follows the harrowing journey of three U.S. military veteran whistleblowers determined to break the silence surrounding the U.S.'s secret drone war. Tortured by guilt for their participation in the killing of faceless so-called suspects abroad, and despite the threats of being prosecuted, these three veterans offer an unprecedented look inside this secret program to reveal the haunting cost of the U.S.'s global drone strikes.
You literally just kind of hover, and you would wait until he walked out to the field to meet with some friends for something, and you'd blow him up. Drop a Hellfire missile on him. Maybe we kill our objective, maybe we killed a guy who we thought was our objective. You don't know.
When I first got into the military and I was thinking it was a force for good in the world, I thought I was going to be on the right side of history, and today I don't believe I was.
I still have a top secret clearance, so I have to be extraordinarily cautious about what I can't say on camera.
My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, and identify everything.
Adolescent near the rear of the SUV.
That's deceptive. You get the opinion that you're at 10,000 feet, you see this photograph, you know what's going on. You don't know what's going on. You know what you see in two dimensions.
You see someone die because you said it was okay to kill them.
It's too easy. They just embolden commanders.
Center's in, let the party begin.
Because there is no threat.
Oh, sweet target.
I mean, this could grow to get so out of control.
Somebody downstairs was knocking at the door, and immediately both people at the door shoved FBI badges in my face.
The Espionage Act is one of the most serious charges you can level against an American.
That I'm probably going to get indicted and I'm probably going to get charged.
I lost part of my humanity working in the drone program. It's a secret program. I can't just go telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, it's frightening.
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Sonja Kennebeck, the director, she won an award for this documentary with the Nation Institute. And she said in her award acceptance speech that she initially set out to make this documentary solely just about drones and drone warfare, but then it developed into something much more than this. Of course, we learn of the stories of the three characters in the documentary, and she wanted to focus also on the consequences of whistleblowing and espionage and all these sorts of issues. And Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, you can always tell there's something in the air, both literally and figuratively in this case, when filmmakers start making films about the same kind of thing. So in recent years, we've had three or four movies on the subjects of drones. We've had this, we've had the documentary called Drone, which is a slightly more arty and abstract version of this story. But we've also had feature films like Good Kill with Ethan Hawke as a drone pilot, and Eye in the Sky, a British film with Alan Rickman and Helen Mirren. So there's clearly something going on that filmmakers, that they want to be a part of this conversation. And I think part of the situation is that we are still all, we're all making our way through this moral maze at the moment. We're all dealing with the ramifications of drone technology. We're trying to figure out what the consequences are, the good points and the bad points. And I think filmmakers like Sonja Kennebeck here, they all want to have a say in that conversation.
And of course, so as you said, there's been a resurgence in this topic of drone warfare and the moral obstacles around it. And we've had, this documentary had Wim Wenders as the executive producer, of course, is a multi-winning, award-winning German filmmaker. How much impact do you think he had in this documentary?
Well, he's one executive producer, and he, you know, Wim Wenders in the past has had an interest in surveillance technology. He made a very interesting film at the end of the last century called The End of Violence, which is about surveillance technology in America as it was back then. And obviously things have moved on very rapidly from that. The other executive producer is Errol Morris, who is, you know, a revered documentarian, and has made things like The Fog of War in the past. So he himself is also very interested in this subject matter. So it obviously helps a young up-and-coming filmmaker when you can get two great filmmakers, two revered filmmakers within the industry, to put their names on the credit of the film. And you know, it all ties in with some of the work they've done in the past.
And Dan, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on National Bird?
Well, I thought it was interesting, but to be honest, I find this quite often with films on this subject, the tendency to focus on the emotional turmoil of the operators and really the perpetrators. I find, to be honest, slightly distasteful, really, given that the primary victims, obviously, of drone warfare are the people getting blown up and getting their legs blown off and so on. And they do feature in the film, and they have quite an extended section in Afghanistan talking to the victims, but you never get the feeling that they get the same full kind of personhood ascribed to them by the filmmaker. You don't see this sort of rich emotional life that's depicted of the operators and the perpetrators, and I feel like that's actually is playing into the hands of the dehumanization that allows things like the drone program to exist. Because yes, Afghans are in the film, but they're just as victims who you know kind of walk around and then get bombed. There's no real feel of what it's like for them, what their lives are like. So I find it difficult.
I see your point, Dan, but one could argue that the role of whistleblowers and journalists, of course, shine a light on these issues, otherwise that would be ignored. And I think Sonia probably emphasizes this in the documentary.
Absolutely, and you know, that what they've done to come out against the program is commendable. But I think even to kind of do justice, if you like, to the operators depicted in the film themselves, you know, what turned them against what they're doing is that at some point they had a realization, my God, these are human beings that I'm killing. They're just like me or my mom or my neighbor. And I don't think that realization that's led to them being racked by guilt is fully given to us as a viewer. And I think that's problematic.
Well, that's a really interesting point. We'll have to pause there just for now.
I was an imagery analyst and a screener. My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, the live video, of course, and identify everything. Another remote duty station, you'd have the pilot, of course, who's flying the actual aircraft, and the sensor operator who is moving the camera around. They were the ones that actually pushed the button. I do not push the button. I just identify what necessitates a button pushing. Bomb someone and fly away. We have to follow through. The bomb hit and wait for it to cool down a little bit, and then you can see like the body parts. You can identify like that could be the lower half of his body, and that could be a leg. And then sometimes you'll stick around and watch family come and get them, or like pick up the parts and put their family member in a blanket, and a couple people hold onto a corner of the blanket and carry him back to their compound.
So it's Heather Limber. So you really feel for her in this documentary. Indeed, the other characters also, but she seems to come across as the one most plagued and crippled by guilt for her role in the drone program. Mike, what do you make of how her character is portrayed?
Well, she's not a million miles away from the Ethan Hawke character in Good Kill, the feature film that came out a couple of years ago, in that, you know, she was very much in the room watching this footage come in. And the sense that I got from her watching this film is that it's very different from being a soldier on the ground. If you're a soldier on the ground, you know pretty much that you've killed someone if you haven't killed someone. The sense that I get from her, the issues that she's working through are connected to the fact that nobody has told her who she's killed, how many people she's killed. This is hanging over her. And you get a sense of this issue bearing down on her. It's like she's got something over her head. And that is a very powerful thing.
Mm. And Dan, I know you say the true victims are, of course, the targets of the drone strikes. But in this documentary, you see Heather and the others almost come across as victims in their own right, and perhaps particularly connected to the US military's recruitment campaigns. I mean, it's sold off, as you see, as a glorious sort of career you could have, and that you're on the right side of history and justice. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
No, certainly, they are victims as well. They're, I mean, secondary victims, I would say, but certainly, I mean, they're recruited into it pretty much as children, and to talk about the majority of drone operators being 18 to 24, so they're recruited at 18, practically children, but they'll be kind of groomed effectively from 16, 17. If you think about the involvement of the Pentagon with the video games industry, they're really being groomed from the age of whenever they start playing video games, 8, 7, 6, into this, you know, into this role. So it's really, it is a form of institutional child abuse within America, you know, what America is doing to its own children, and here in this country, in Britain as well, same thing. So, yeah, certainly, and of course they're sold, as you say, the idea of being on the right side of history. One of the people involved in the program said,
"They have this real sense of moral righteousness, and that they set out to do the right thing. Yeah. They had good intentions at heart."
Exactly, but it's it is child abuse, and you see the impact, and the fact that they're not even allowed to talk to therapists because the therapists don't have security clearance. So the other thing that they would want to discuss is classified, and so on. So absolutely, the treatment of them by the military is shocking. And you hear testimony from Heather in the film that her kind of commanding officers were constantly questioning her judgment. She was saying, "I think there's women and children here," and so on. And they're saying, "Are you sure? I don't think so. Let's fire anyway," and being overruled and so on. Absolutely. They are victims as well. I just don't think they're the primary victims.
That's a good point. And Mike, I just really quickly want to talk about the shots that are used in this documentary. We see a lot of aerial shots. And do you think the director did this intentionally to give the Western viewer the sense of what it's like to be watched? Because a lot of the shots are in US sort of suburban areas.
Yeah, I mean, the film sort of flips on its head halfway through, and we get a sense that the people who've been employed as watchers are now the watched. And that is very much there in all those drone shots over American cities, American towns. Drones have revolutionized the way movies in general have been made, because now it's much cheaper to do aerial shots rather than hiring big bulky crane equipment. You can just fly a plane or fly a drone above people's heads. So that has changed as well. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing so many films on this subject. The technology, the form and the content are married in this respect.
I think one of the strengths of the documentary is it shows how barbaric and brutal drone strikes are. And Mike, if I could ask you, what did you make of this journey to Afghanistan and this story?
I liked it very much. I mean, we see so many documentaries that set out their case in the first hour and then spend the second hour driving home the same points over and over again. Here, I think you get a sense of a story developing in real time. There was a sense that this technology has been thrust upon us, and like I say, we're all making and negotiating our way through this moral maze. And when it does finally get to Afghanistan, you get a sense there from that clip, the plane comes over, of just how normalized this kind of life has been. I mean, the fact it's called National Bird, would suggest that the drone has now become part of the natural order of things, part of the landscape for so many people. In ways both good and terrifying.
Mm, that's a really interesting point. And Dan, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Mike just said? What did you make of the journey to Afghanistan in this documentary?
Well, I was glad they included it, because about 40 minutes into the film, I thought, are we going to hear anything from any Afghans whatsoever? And they did spend an extended period of time in Afghanistan. But as I said, I still didn't feel really they came across fully as agents. They were still depicted as, they were shown as suffering and as victims, but there's portrayed as only victims, as kind of passive recipients, really, of U.S. air power. There was no agency there, no narrative, no Afghan narrative was present, and there was no politics whatsoever in the film. And I think there's a real danger. The Glasgow Media Group had a really interesting study out a few years ago on the Palestine-Israel conflict, and they found that a lot of journalists were quite sympathetic to the Palestinians, but they knew that they weren't really allowed in Western media to actually put forward a Palestinian narrative about resistance to occupation and so on. So instead of that, in place of that, they just paraded an endless parade of Palestinian suffering, but overlain with an Israeli narrative to justify it. Mm-hmm. And I think the danger by not giving any kind of Afghan narrative, we see the Afghan suffering, but there's no narrative, there's no other side of the story. The danger is that you have the same thing with the Palestine-Israel conflict, was people have pity for the Palestinians, but the overall view in the West, whenever Israel attacks, is, well, it's a sort of necessary evil in the war against terrorism. It's terribly sad, and we pity them, but it kind of has to be done. And I think there's a danger this film will have the same effect. People feel sorry for the Afghans, they'll pity them, but won't necessarily just see, oh, it's a shame these innocent bystanders die and so on, but that's kind of necessary.
Mike, so would you have liked to see more political context to this documentary?
There's certainly scope for a more comprehensive and possibly slightly drier documentary about drone technology and the politics of deployment. I mean, this is not a film about the systemic application of drone technology. It's not about the technological specifics of it. It is a human story, and those are the documentaries that tend to get sold at international marketplaces, play at festivals these days, because they're very easy to relate to. Mm-hmm. I still think we're in the early days, the early days of this technology, and there will be a more comprehensive documentary than the ones that we've seen so far. But in terms of a primer of how this affects both the watched and the watchers, I thought it was pretty solid.
Mm. Well, thank you for that point.
This is global. This is getting information anywhere at any time, shooting people from anywhere at any time, and it's not just one person sitting there with a little remote control, a little joystick, moving around a plane that's halfway across the world. That's not all there is. It's like borders don't matter anymore, and there's a huge system that spans the globe that can just suck up endless amounts of your life, your personal data. I mean, this could grow to get so out of control. And we're not the only ones that have this. This is going to be commonplace, if it's not already. It's a secret program. And what that means is that I can't just go shouting off the hilltops telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, one person who worked within this massive thing, it's frightening.
So Mike, in the documentary we hear from President Obama give a televised speech talking about the drone warfare operation. And he says how it operates in such a way to ensure minimal loss of life and that they're precise and surgical strikes. Of course, in the documentary, we learn that it isn't really that precise. And Daniel even says, one of the characters, that an element of guesswork is involved. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, I mean, everyone does seem to be operating in some kind of grey area. I mean, we've seen from the clips that actually the images that the drones beam back to the operators in America are very fuzzy. I mean, there's a degree of ambiguity in those very images, never mind in the ethics of using this technology. And so what's interesting is what the film says about the way this technology has been sold to us. So it's clearly been sold to young army recruits as an exciting new development of the war on terror. And we see the adverts in the films that are all, they are like an advert for a computer game, as you say. But there's also a degree to which you think someone must have sold President Obama on this, that this is a new, clean way of killing, that you're killing, you're somehow keeping killing at arm's length, but you're still getting dirty hands. And I think this is something that all the people in the film are wrestling with.
Mm. Now, Dan, I think many people would be surprised to find that actually there were 10 times more strikes during President Obama's presidency than under George W. Bush, his predecessor. What do you make of Obama's role in the drone warfare?
Well, on the one hand, drone warfare is a kind of terrifying, dystopian kind of future brought into the present. But at the same time, that shouldn't blind us to the fact that it is driven by desperation on the part of the Western powers. They tried big ground operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the fallout in terms of blood and treasure was so great that they just are not in a position to do that again. Mm-hmm. Colin Powell said the U.S. Army is just about broken by Iraq. So they don't have that option. So when you say, it was Obama who sold Obama on this idea, well, the reality was he didn't, if he wanted to continue making war, and there's a whole systemic pressure to do so within the U.S. government apparatus, then you know, that former options have been ruled out. Mm. It's no longer feasible to have these mass ground scale.
Like in the Vietnam War, over 50,000 U.S. personnel died,
right.
And this was one of the factors that led to pressure the government to pull out.
Yeah.
But do you think if they had drones at the time, that they would just have an endless war?
Well, it's an interesting question, isn't it? And quite feasibly, yeah, because it was the body bags coming home from Vietnam that drove the pressure to end the war. You're right. With mm-hmm. drones, there's no U.S. body bags. There's only Afghan body bags. And then there's obviously mental health fallout. Well, it's interesting, the U.S. casualties do exist. Heather talked about three of her friends on the drone program committing suicide. Mm-hmm. But of course, that doesn't have this generate the same headlines as a coffin coming home draped in a flag. Mm.
And a final say to you, Mike, would you recommend this documentary?
I think it's certainly worth watching. I think, you know, this is one of those technologies that has proliferated very quickly. And like I say, we're all still wrestling with the ramifications of it, the consequences of it. It's not a bad place to start. I still think there'll be a more comprehensive documentary some years down the line.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your insight. And that's all the time we have for this episode of Doc Review. And thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
our fifth holy Imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, had a natural disposition for doing good, spending on the people, and making them happy. Ibn Sabbagh al-Maliki said, though Muhammad ibn Ali ibn al-Husayn al-Baqir had knowledge, outstanding merits, leadership, and imamat, his generosity was apparent in Shia and non-Shia. He was famous for generosity for all people, and he was known for favor and kindness in spite of his big family and his middle condition.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Now, going through the historical texts, we find that there are some very beautiful dialogues between Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and his fellow companions or his fellow friends, his fellow students, or the contemporaries of his time. Now, we find that one of his most knowledgeable students and one of his most famous and loyal companions, by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi, has a dialogue with his imam, with his teacher, with his guide, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now, this dialogue and this conversation between the teacher and the student, the imam and his follower, is quite a long discussion, but we have decided to take out bits and pieces of this long conversation and speak about them in our programs. Now, one of the things which Imam al-Baqir, peace and blessings upon him, says to Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi in this dialogue is, seek the help of Allah when remembering past sins by the means of sincere supplication and whispered prayers in the darkness. So, dear friends, we had talked about in one of our previous programs that one of the things which we should do actively, without getting overwhelmed, is to remember our past sins, and of course, more important than remembering the past sins, is to ask for forgiveness and seek the mercy of Allah in order to purify and cleanse ourselves. And so here Imam al-Baqir further tells Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi that when you are remembering the past sins, seek the help of Allah. Perhaps he is telling us here that we should not become drowned simply in the remembrance of these past sins, these past errors, these past mistakes, but rather we must try to find a way to ascend towards the heavens by remembering to ask for forgiveness from Allah, who is surely the most quick to forgive. And so, dear friends, we find that Imam al-Baqir says, when you are remembering the past sins and you have become intensely regretful and ashamed, and then have a sincere supplication with Allah and have a whispered prayer with Allah, where no one else is present. It is just you and your Creator. It is just you and the one who sustains your life and gives you life after death. So remember the past sins, but also remember that the remembrance of these past sins is only a means. It is only a vehicle in order to help us ascend towards Allah, the Almighty, the Exalted, via sincere supplications and whispered prayers from the bottom of our hearts and souls. Beautiful words in this dialogue between Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
One of the distinctions of the Islamic faith in general, and especially the emphasis that we see in the Shia path of Islam, is about the value and importance of ilm and knowledge in human society. It is about the knowledge of religion as well as the knowledge of what is known as the secular world. Quran was the last revelation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And there was a reason why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala did not choose to send Surah Al-Fatiha as the beginning. The name of that surah is Fatiha. Al-Fatiha means the opening chapter. But yet he didn't send that. The first ayat to be revealed was from Surah Alaq. And there was a reason. It was in a way emphasizing the point that this is a religion and a faith which is based on the issue of knowledge. Iqra, the first word, read. Read in the name of your Lord who created the human being from one cloth. Iqra wa rabbuka al-akram alladhi 'allama bil qalam. The Lord who taught you by the means of the pen. So you have the word iqra and the word al-qalam right in the first verses which were revealed. And when you look at the symbolism there, you know, reading and writing are the means by which people acquire knowledge and spread knowledge. Interestingly, the second surah to be revealed after Surah Al-Alaq is the surah known as Suratul Qalam. So this symbolism is very powerful as far as, you know, what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala envisions for the last ummah, that it will be an ummah, you know, which gives importance to knowledge and ilm. Our Prophet, you know, is known as Madinatul Ilm. He is the city of the knowledge. Our first Imam is known as Bab Madinatul Ilm. He is the gate to the city of the knowledge. And if you look at Nahj al-Balagha, Amir al-Mu'mineen says, you know, قِيمَةُ كُلِّ إِمْرَئٍ مَّا يُحْسِنُ. The value of every human being is dependent on the knowledge that he has. And this is where we come to realize that, you know, for us, this issue of knowledge, seeking knowledge and spreading knowledge is very, very important.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.